This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On a hot, sunny afternoon last May, about 5,000 supporters jammed Burlington's lakefront to hear Senator Bernie Sanders say he was making a run for the presidency as a Democrat.
Today, with your support and the support of millions of people throughout our country, we begin a political revolution to transform our country economically, politically, socially, and environmentally.
More than a year later, Sanders is still making waves and influencing the Democratic Party. Over the weekend, DNC Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz was forced to announce that she'll be resigning her post following this week's convention after leaked documents revealed what some Bernie supporters had long suspected, that the party establishment was actively trying to limit the potential of his campaign. Today on the program, we're going to look back at the timeline of the Vermont senator's campaign for the presidency, and we'll talk about what lasting effects he could have on the Democratic Party. Listeners, please share your perspective with us. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're joined today by Jeff Charlotte, an author and journalist who focuses some of his writings on threats to American democracy. He teaches at Dartmouth College. Jeff, it's nice to have you back on the show.
Hi, Jane. Good to be with you.
And we're joined by Matt Dickinson, a professor of political science at Middlebury College. Matt, hasn't been that long. Feels like we just had you on the other day. Nice to have you back.
It's always good to be with you, Jane.
So let's talk a little bit about back in time now, back last May, when Sanders officially announced he was running. We just heard that little cut of tape brings us back to that sunny May day. Not long after he officially announced his candidacy, former Vermont governor and former DNC chair and former Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean told our program that Bernie Sanders Democrats expecting a Hillary Clinton coronation would be well advised to take Bernie more seriously.
You have to confront the issue of income inequality, and Bernie Sanders is up there. He's a good debater. He doesn't get personal and make personal attacks. He sticks to the issues. I have counseled the Clinton folks to take him very seriously.
Now, of course, Howard Dean did endorse Hillary Clinton, but at the time, a lot of politicians, frankly, a lot of journalists, saw Bernie Sanders as this sort of fringe candidate who was going to flare out quickly and perhaps didn't need to be taken all that seriously. Obviously, they were wrong, but Jeff Charlotte, do you think they should have known better and taken Bernie Sanders more seriously from the start?
I think so. The political press and the pundits are sort of organized around establishment politics and inclined to look at candidates like Bernie Sanders with just that term, fringe, and to see this as another Ralph Nader. In fact, of course, Ralph Nader turned out to be very influential in 2000. And when we speak of the fringe in American politics, we have to be careful to think about what kind of numbers we're talking about. Even a small percentage means millions of people. That's not a fringe. And if you consider American history and the ways in which small groups of people have often turned the tides, I think it would have been more reasonable in retrospect to understand the great potential in the Sanders movement and then on the other side in the Trump movement that there was – this was a year of upsetting the table.
Did you see it back a year plus ago?
I was one of the ones who – that's why I was careful to add in retrospect because I should have. And I think in May I didn't. And when it came around to Trump, I started realizing this is actually going to work and this is going to work for all sorts of reasons that the people making fun of him aren't understanding about populism and the ways in which populism can slide left and right. And I think by that summer, once I realized that Trump had legs – And I feel terrible saying this, but I only could see Bernie once I saw Trump. I think in a lot of people, once they realized Trump had legs, that was the clue that there was this moment. But then there's also a history of the political press being a little quicker to understand and recognize right-wing insurgencies in American political life than left-wing ones. Left-wing ones are closer to the mildly liberal-leaning press, and so there's always an overcorrection for bias and a kind of dismissal that Bernie is not the first one to fall victim to.
I think a lot of people were also thinking back to 2012 and the Republican candidates in the primary season who it did seem like it was one after another, this sort of really fast rise into sort of first place in the polls and then a really precipitous drop, and perhaps thinking that was what 2016 was going to look like. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that's actually that we saw that in 2012, but in fact we've been seeing that now for some time. And this is where I think we can't blame our colleagues in the press or even ourselves for missing this right away is to recognize that movements especially are on a much faster cycle than they used to be. And those who do study American history have this idea of movement building and the sort of the slow progress. But then we saw something like in 2011, the Occupy Wall Street movement, which the press ignored until finally they realized, oh, this is something big, just in time for it to be collapsed or to be crushed, however you want to see it. And so it's been going for a while, movements rising and falling very quickly. And I think the mistake now is to say those are flashes in the pan, instead to recognize that we are in an era of political wildfire, that these are the equivalent of wildcat strikes, and there's going to be more and more and more of them. And whether this candidate takes or that candidate takes is missing the point of this rapid cycling political life that we've entered into.
Matt Dickinson, what do you think? I mean, you are not a member of the political press, but you are certainly called upon by the political press to share your thoughts and to pontificate and to project. I mean, that's one of the main things that we do in the press is ask people like you, tell us what you think is going to happen. And, you know, sort of like Howard Dean, you were counseling people a year ago to, you know, think pretty hard about the fact that Bernie Sanders might have a point that resonated with the American populace.
Well, let's not go too far in
in the praise. All right, forget
yes.
it. You were terrible.
Well, no, don't take it all back. I did talk to reporters early and projected a ceiling of about 35% support and popular vote among those voting in the Democratic contest. And I think at the time, people thought I was wildly optimistic. In retrospect, again, using Jeff's term, I was actually pessimistic because he garnered about 45% of the vote, so he exceeded my expectations. And I think there's a couple of reasons why he did that. One is the issues that he has been talking about for two decades suddenly resonated. They became relevant, income inequality. So much like Howard Dean with the Iraq War in 2004, this time chose Bernie. His message suddenly found an audience. Second, the Democratic Party has been moving left for a couple decades. If you compare, for instance, the Democratic platform on immigration in 1996 to the one they just passed in 2016, the 1996 platform sounds like something Donald Trump would sign on to. They talked about securing the borders and making sure only legal immigrants were coming in and protecting jobs. Now they're talking much more about path to citizenship and so on. So Bernie took advantage of not only the issues but the fact that the Democratic Party has moved in his direction over the last couple of decades. And I don't think we really saw that when he first announced, but it soon became clear that there was an audience out there for him.
It seems almost like you could have the two surrogates for the two nominees switch conventions in which they speak. You could have Bill Clinton speaking at the Republican National Convention and have Ivanka Trump come to the Democrats. She was talking, you know, she hit all of the Democrats' line in her speech in advance of her father. It does seem like this sort of swapping of roles, Matt Dickinson, given what the platform was in the 90s for the Democrats.
It's an interesting and I think Jeff alluded to this when Trump did well, you thought, well, Sanders has a shot too, in part because both of them are arguing along parallel paths that the system is rigged, that there is a forgotten man, to use Trump's very well-chosen words, alluding back to a famous speech by Franklin Roosevelt, and he's going to provide a voice. Much like Bernie said, I'm going to be a voice for those forgotten 99%. And Ivanka Trump, I think, articulated some of those themes, and now it's questionable whether she was speaking for herself or her father, but it is an indication that this is not your father's Republican Party anymore. And to a certain extent, there's some overlap on the anti-trade issues and the need to redress income inequality that unites supporters of Sanders and Trump. The big difference, of course, is that for Sanders, the solution to this is more government. That's not necessarily the case for Trump.
We're talking today about Bernie Sanders' campaign. We're sort of looking back, reflecting. He's set to speak tonight at the Democratic National Convention, and you can tune into VPR at 8 to hear all of that coverage. But as we prepare for this speech, anticipate this speech, we're looking back on the Bernie Sanders campaign and would love to hear your perspective. You can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Carrie in Montpelier who says, "What the Bernie campaign revealed to me is that there are many people on the far left who resemble people on the far right. They are quick to demonize anyone who disagrees with them. They don't acknowledge the complexity and nuance of today's problems, and they reject compromise, failing to understand that politics is about negotiation, not getting everything you want. There's nothing wrong with idealism or righteous anger, but we progressives should always make sure that in this heated political environment, we don't descend to the level of the Tea Party." So Carrie's pretty pointed in her critiques there. What do you think, Jeff Charlotte?
I mean, she's speaking of the people that I think the Clinton campaign very successfully labeled as Bernie bros. And by successfully, I mean in terms of sort of owning the narrative for a while. And those people absolutely do exist. And at the same time, one of the sort of interesting things about this moment was the temptation of the press to see the Bernie supporters through the lens of a paradigm they already had, which was the Tea Party, and to collapse it into that. And you know, and I think back to sort of covering the Trump campaign trail and various people I'd meet at Trump rallies who were maybe sort of on the fence, and they would vote. I remember in Youngstown, Ohio, a whole group of Democrats, they said, "We'd vote for Sanders if we thought he had a chance, but maybe we're going to vote for Trump instead. We don't like his racism. We don't really believe he's going to bring the steel mills back, but we just like to hear it." That's not Tea Party rhetoric. That is it's a rhetoric that's in some ways kind of sorrowful and kind of longing. And I found that much more common once you got beyond the sort of the campaign activists. I think it's easy to be blinded by the people who are the most vocal. But remember, you know, the whatever 14 million people voted for Bernie Sanders, most of them were not Bernie bros.
Well, let's look back to February when Bernie Sanders actually won the New Hampshire primary by 20 points. Afterwards, he spoke to a really jubilant crowd in the Concord High School gymnasium.
"We have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California."
So, Matt Dickinson, was there ever any time when you thought Bernie Sanders might actually win the nomination, given what Jeff was just talking about and his victories in some of the early primary and caucusing states?
The short answer is no, although he exceeded my expectations. But they had a very I would say a razor-thin strategy in the sense of the likelihood of success, and it was this. He pulls an upset in Iowa, which he almost did. He wins in New Hampshire, which he did in far exceeding my expectations, as you noted, over 20% victory. And then he wanted to take Nevada. And had he done that, then the argument is the press would begin to view the campaign as legitimate in going into Super Tuesday. They weren't going to do well in South Carolina, but going into Super Tuesday, if they could hold Clinton to a draw, then all bets were off and the race would be reshaped. And of course, remember, the media, and I'm not being critical of them, but they did not want to see a Hillary Clinton coronation. They wanted a horse race. They were a little bit slow to recognize that Bernie was the alternative horse. But once they did, he actually received far more favorable coverage than she did.
So, I can hear heads shaking right now in our listening area even, yeah. Matt, because a lot of people felt like he didn't get the time of day from the press. And you're not saying that he got more press, but that it was more favorable?
Well, they're correct. Initially, he got much less coverage than she did. She was a better-known candidate, and the news stories were all basically talking about her coronation. But our studies of the major news outlets, print and broadcast, show that he got far more favorable coverage, and the amount of coverage he received began to approach hers near the end, although in the aggregate, she still got more coverage. But yeah, that's one of the big misnomers, and I don't believe the Bernie supporters are going to accept my explanation, but our studies show that he got far more favorable coverage.
Let's go to Carmen, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Carmen. What are you thinking?
I think the pundits from traditional media got caught off guard because they were not really, they didn't have their finger on the online scene of coverage that was going on. A lot of it was missed. And, you know, they kept referring to the supporters of Bernie being young people, but it was actually the connected people that were really powerful behind the tsunami of his rise. And shows like The Young Turks have really grown exponentially and have been very impactful.
Carmen, did you count yourself among those people? Did you feel like you were seeing things in sort of alternative areas to established press outlets that were giving you a different message or informing you in a different way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was really shocked at the way that the Hillary Clinton campaign, I mean, how powerful they were in and strategic they were in trying to portray Bernie in a certain manner, and how the establishment, I mean, we all suspected, I mean, so many of us, that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was putting her finger on the scale and, you know, starting out with limiting the number of debates and threatening to penalize any candidate who went outside those debates by not allowing them to be in any of them if they did, because Bernie very early on was willing to debate the Republican candidates, but he would have, you know, been restricted from the Democratic debates. So,
Carmen, I take your point and I appreciate it. And I want to put it to our guests, because this idea of, you know, things happening in spaces other than the establishment media, Jeff Charlotte, I mean, that absolutely seems true, that there were conversations happening in lots of different places. It's a really diffuse media these days. And, you know, Carmen and others, and she pointed out, connected young people are getting their information and sharing it and having conversations in much different spaces than their parents and grandparents were.
Yeah, I think Carmen is right in a lot of senses about that. And I wonder if that might make for sort of an additional element to the kind of studies that Matt's talking about, which are really important, because, of course, there is this sort of greater favorability in major media. But what do you mean by major media these days? And one of the things that I was struck by was how many of my colleagues in the press who were covering campaigns, especially those who might be identified as sort of liberals or pundits or something like that, were quietly really – this is true – really in the tank for Hillary and frustrated by Sanders' endurance. And they weren't looking for a horse race. They saw the big fight with the Republicans ahead. But that kind of conversation was taking place online. And I think it's not just young people who get their information online. We know that the average Twitter user is actually middle-aged. My college students won't even barely touch Twitter. It's us old folks who are using that as well. And I think the media atmosphere environment is expanding sort of so rapidly that it's hard to keep up with where this is happening. And I think the real fight over media representations of Bernie took place online, both in terms of the movement that the traditional press missed, but also in terms of traditional press people going online to sort of throw elbows that they might not in their network coverage or their newspaper coverage.
Matt Dickinson, do you see it that way too?
I think Jeff's on to something. The importance of social media can't be overstated in this election cycle. One of the ironies of Bernie's campaign is he talks about Citizens United and how it empowered the wealthy. But in fact, he showed just the opposite, that you can run a campaign, a well-funded campaign, without relying on super PACs. He basically demonstrated that Citizens United is practically irrelevant. And how did he do that? But he raised tons of money online through social media. It's also the case, I think Jeff's absolutely right, and people are increasingly creating their own sort of echo chambers using social media and gravitating towards those platforms in which the conversation tends to be more pleasant to their ears. And that leads to sort of a fracturing of political discourse that we didn't see in the golden age when media was controlled by three major broadcast networks and a few major print networks. So there's a lot more, you know, I would say, partitioning of the social media, and it was easy for people to gravitate to that audience that they found most favorable.
We're talking about Bernie today, Bernie Sanders, and his run for the presidency and what it's meant, where it has taken place, these conversations happening in other spaces. And we're hearing from many of you, more of your comments, your notes and emails and calls to come. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. As we prepare to hear Bernie Sanders speak tonight at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, let's listen back to one of the most famous moments of the campaign season. Last year in Las Vegas, the Democratic presidential candidates held their first debate hosted by CNN. That's when Bernie gave Hillary Clinton a lifeline.
Let me say something that may not be great politics, but I think the secretary is right. And that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
You know?
That may be one of the most enduring lines of this campaign season. More Bernie Sanders still to come. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're spending the hour looking back at the campaign that came to be known by the phrase, feel the burn. We're remembering key moments in the Sanders campaign and thinking about what, if any, lasting effect his candidacy could have on the Democratic Party. What do you think? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking today with journalist and author Jeff Charlotte, who's written about threats to American democracy and has been following this campaign season closely, and with Middlebury College poli-sci professor Matt Dickinson, who we could say the same about. And let's go to Donna, who's calling in from Jeffersonville. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I stood yesterday on the Capitol steps in Montpelier with a group of people that were honoring the 100 city tribute to Bernie. I felt compelled to go there. I've been singing folk songs since we tried to do some movement back in the early 70s. And it was those songs that we rallied around to keep Bernie going. One thing that I noticed and what I said from the steps was that I would vote for Bernie and vote my conscience regardless of the political system, because I think it's time to do that, and we've gotten there. We've gotten there through everyone sharing information on the internet, for sure. But what I think about Bernie is he's big enough to know that this movement is bigger than him. And now he's standing for a group of very quiet people who are ready to do the right thing. They're ready to do the right thing. And there are a lot of us out here who want to do the right thing. And Bernie's the one that I see that has the courage to stand with us. Not necessarily for us, but with us.
So what exactly does that mean, though, moving forward, Donna, for you? I mean, leaving aside November, what does that mean?
Moving forward means no matter what happens in November, the people who feel the way they do about the political system and the economic situation, they're just going to do what they do one by one. And, you know, they're going to stand together, and hopefully they will vote their conscience.
Donna, thanks for your call. I appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Richard, who's calling in from Haverhill, Massachusetts. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Jane. I disagree with that first email you got from Montpelier comparing the left with the Tea Party. Finally, we do have an emerging left coming into being. And I just think that both parties are really conservative. I mean, we got the far right from the Republicans and the center-right from the Democrats. They both depend on the Wall Street corporate money from the bankers and the hedge funders. And that's why Hillary, she gets most of her money from them. And if she doesn't turn her campaign into a populist movement and campaign, because that's what Donald Trump is doing. He's using that theme about the white working class, and the Democrats, over the years, they have not talked about the underclass, the working class, and the shrinking middle class.
So, Richard, it sounds like you're excited to hear what you see as a far-left voice being stronger.
Absolutely. That's why I'm going to vote for Jill Stein, because Jill, domestically and foreign policy-wise, she's talking my what I like to hear. She's talking about militarism, permanent war, and a new Cold War with Russia. We got troops going into Eastern Europe and armaments. Suppose they had troops in Mexico or up in Canada. Well, how would we feel? I'm voting for Jill Stein, Jane.
All right, Richard, I thank you for your call today. Let's get another thought in here from Reg in Bennington. Hi, Reg. Where are you standing today?
Well, my thought is that the problems with the DNC and the corruption that is causing Debbie Wasserman Schultz to leave is more pervasive than maybe people recognize. It was pretty obvious from the beginning that she was trying to prevent debates or hold them opposite a Super Bowl or something. But you also have cases where Harry Reid is stepping in and Schumer and some of the other party officials, if you will, where you have, for instance, Joe Sestak, who I think would be a much stronger candidate in Pennsylvania than McGuinty, but he wouldn't kowtow to Harry Reid, and Harry Reid made sure he didn't get elected. And down in Florida right now, to try and beat Rubio, you have Alan Grayson, who's been a very, you know, productive, constructive congressman, now running for Senate, and Harry Reid is taking Democratic Party money and seeing that it's going to Grayson's primary opponent, who was a Republican, until he jumped in to say, I'm with you, Harry, and get elected as a Democrat kind of thing. So I think that the corruption and power in both parties needs to be addressed. And I, for one, am thankful that these emails have come out and made public what I think an awful lot of people have known all along.
Reg, thanks for your call. And Matt Dickinson and Jeff Charlotte, let's talk a little bit about this situation with the leaked emails. I think it was something like 20,000 emails released over the weekend, just on the eve of the Democratic National Convention. And as you might imagine, we're getting some emails from people about that and comments. Mark says, do the leaked emails, the resignation of Wasserman Schultz, the role of superdelegates, and the whole classified emails flap with subsequent non-prosecution diminish the successful campaign of Hillary Clinton in any way? Is the fact that she's going to be the first woman nominated by a major party to run for president in any way overshadowed by these controversies around the election this year? And Steve says, on the heels of the DNC email leak and the resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her subsequent hiring by the Clinton campaign, it will be interesting to hear what Senator Sanders has to say in his primetime speech. We progressives keep hearing about party unity and gotta back Clinton to defeat Trump. But now we're seeing growing evidence of party shenanigans and active attempts to derail and minimize Bernie's populist insurgency. And when Clinton hires Wasserman Schultz, who resigned in disgrace after evidence showed she and others were not playing fair, Clinton hires her and her special skills. Is that how Clinton woos progressives? Matt Dickinson, what do you think about this? I mean, this is still emerging. Wasserman Schultz announced officially this morning, I think, that she'll be resigning after the convention. But this is still in play on this day that is supposed to be about party unity for the Democrats. They were hoping to have smoother sailing than the Republicans.
Yeah, the irony is I just got back from the Republican National Convention, which actually proved to be less divisive than I expected. And here I come home and suddenly the Democratic Party is imploding before our eyes. This is in great optics. But, you know, there's no surprise here that the Democratic establishment in certain ways favored Clinton, because the bottom line is the party wants to win. They want to win in November. And for all the support and passion of Bernie's followers, which I admire greatly, many of my students are in the vanguard, he hasn't demonstrated that he was going to be a strong general election candidate. And, you know, the role of the superdelegates is not to be Democratic. It's to ensure that the candidate who has the better chance of winning in November gets the nomination. Now, you may not like that, and you may want to change the rules, but you can't say they somehow acted contrary to their purpose. So, You know, the problem, the big elephant in the room here that we haven't talked about is Bernie was unable to expand his coalition to non-white voters. And ultimately, that's the ace in the hole for the Democratic Party heading into November. No matter how much Donald Trump expands his support among the white working class, demographics are still working against him winning the overall election unless he can expand his support among non-white voters. And Bernie just did not demonstrate any affinity for that type of voter.
Well, let's go back and listen to one of the moments that sort of illustrates that point that Matt Dickinson is making. And this is from last August when Black Lives Matter protesters interrupted one of Bernie Sanders' rallies.
Thank you, Seattle, for being one of the most progressive cities in the United States of America.
We want an opportunity on the mic.
Well, ask him.
Get him in check and we're shutting this event down. Now, if you do not listen to her, your event will be shut down right now. Right now. Your decision. Make a decision now.
So that's when protesters actually got up on the dais. They took control of the microphone, and it was an awkward scene for Bernie Sanders, but not the only one that showed that he was struggling to reach non-white voters. Jeff Charlotte, could he or should he have done more in that arena?
You know, I think what's interesting is that I think he did do more in that arena, and I think I know I'm sort of going back to the press as my colleagues in the press is the real culprit here. But I think there was a conflation, this idea of something, this mythical thing called the black vote, as if it's this one grand unified vote, and this assumption by the mostly white press that the black vote is necessarily going to line up with the most left candidate, and that somehow Bernie's failure to achieve this meant that he wasn't nearly as racially progressive as he thought he was. And I think when you look at the Hillary coalition of black voters, the black churches from which she was drawing support, these are not the most left voters. Meanwhile, when you looked at Black Lives Matter activists, you saw this concerted effort by the Sanders campaign to reach out to them and to do this sort of coalition building. And you saw a lot more Black Lives Matter organizers, the people who are sort of steadily in the street and doing the work, like Sean King, supporting Sanders. But that didn't translate into mass numbers, as Matt says. What could Sanders have done? That's where you get into the long-term building. That's what the Democratic Party is good at. It's good at organizing the everyday folks who are not going to have as much time to follow every twist and turn of politics. And that's true of black voters, white voters, all kinds of voters. So I don't know that there's anything he could have done. I do think that my colleagues in the press really contributed to that, that conflation of the monolithic black vote. And I think that's dangerous, and I think it's actually fundamentally racist as well, and something that hopefully we took a step toward eroding or breaking down this election cycle.
Listeners, do you see that? Do you see the press here as one of the main culprits? And I recognize that I am part of that press as I ask that question. What are you thinking? What are you seeing now as the future here for supporters of Bernie Sanders, for Senator Sanders himself, for the Democratic Party? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can share your perspective on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In June, after the last of the Super Tuesdays that included California and New Jersey, Bernie Sanders was still not ready to concede that his campaign was over.
We are going to fight hard to win the primary in Washington, D.C. And then we take our fight for social, economic, racial, and environmental justice to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Just 2 weeks ago, though, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders did throw his support to rival Hillary Clinton.
I have come here today not to talk about the past, but to focus on the future. That future will be shaped more by what happens on November 8th in voting booths across our nation than by any other event in the world. I have come here to make it as clear as possible as to why I am endorsing Hillary Clinton. She must become our next president.
So Bernie Sanders has said he will do everything he can to make sure that Hillary Clinton gets elected and to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't. But he's also said he is going to take the fight to Philadelphia. He's going to speak tonight. And the question is, what happens beyond? What happens after Philadelphia? What happens to this movement, this political revolution that Bernie Sanders has been agitating for? If you have a thought on that, listeners, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or continue the conversation on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking today with Middlebury College political science professor Matt Dickinson and journalist and author Jeff Charlotte, who focuses some of his writings on threats to American democracy. And we're hearing from many of you as well. Let's go to Mark, who's calling in from Fletcher. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Jane, I listen to you a lot, but with all due respect, I have to say that the press squandered many opportunities to define the real issues, and they didn't. And they just played the status quo game. And Bernie made a mistake early on by pledging to support Hillary. I think if he, at this point, before the Portsmouth endorsement, had realized any of these things would have happened, it would have been easy for him to jump the party, take everybody with him, form a coalition with the Greens, the Progressives, and even the Libertarians, and do exactly what he said. A lot, I think the vote would have been there. He had the excitement. Everybody's just holding their nose to vote for the lesser of two evils now, as usual, and the press is complicit up to there. Well, I'll leave it there.
Mark, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. And I take your point and I hear your pointed critique. Jeff Charlotte, I want to ask you about that, though. I mean, Bernie Sanders' campaign officers were saying months ago that they felt like they may not have used the word shenanigans as one of our listeners did, but they felt like this process was rigged against them. I mean, you can hear that ringing in Bernie Sanders' voice. He's said the process is rigged from the start, and they did feel like the Democratic National Committee was pushing towards Hillary Clinton. So we've heard that from him many times, and yet he still did decide to endorse Hillary Clinton. Do you think he feels like he can make more indentations with the Democratic Party in this case than by doing something like what Mark would like to see, which is go over to the Green Party? We talked to Jill Stein just a week or so ago, and she said she would still step aside if Bernie Sanders wanted to run as a third party candidate with the Greens, but doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Look, I think Sanders is also looking very seriously, as many people are, at this incredible problem of lesser of two evilism, and you know, we've been crying wolf for decades of this election is the one that matters, and maybe this one is. But you know, that said, that idea of naming a system as rigged, and as Matt said, this is not a surprise. But on the other hand, the Clinton people who are trying to say – the Clinton surrogates are saying, oh, everyone knew this, are ignoring the fact that yes, and that's exactly what sort of Sanders campaigned on, saying this is a fixed system that is not democratic, not small d democratic, and let's change it. Recognizing that is not the same as being able to beat it. You can say, look, this is rigged against me, or it was biased against me, it's unfair. That doesn't mean I can win. And I think whatever Sanders does is actually not very important if we look at this rapid cycle of left movements over the last decade. I think Sanders will actually probably disappear from that level of prominence pretty quickly. And what the next form or variation of left movements, whether it's an expansion of Black Lives Matter or something coming out of environmentalism or a return to something like Occupy, we can't predict it. But these things are going to be rising and falling and rising and falling and building steam much more rapidly. So this sort of the electoral game that Sanders could have played, the sort of the Ralph Nader 2000 electoral game, I don't think that 2000 strategy is as relevant to the shape of the left in America in 2016 and beyond as it once was.
Let's hear from Ken, who's calling in from Essex. Hi, Ken. You're on.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So my question actually is – it addresses that because – my concern, and I'd like to hear, you know, the thoughts of your guests, is that this is actually a missed opportunity from the Democratic Party to realize that this may not be a short movement. This could actually be a true populist movement, and Trump has tapped into it on the right via angry rhetoric. It's very easy to blame it on things like immigration and, you know, and pointing it, you know, where we're not spending our money intelligently. My concern is that there was a coalition of young people that helped elect Barack Obama, and that by not recognizing them as a valuable part of the party, in that they're largely populist, they largely are behind a Sanders, right? That moving forward, those voters will be less attracted to the Democratic Party as a whole. And if you look at what Clinton has done now in two steps, particularly by one, picking Kaine as her vice president, which is a move towards the right. That's the classic centrist move to try and go grab the votes that, you know, her husband got in the 90s. And two, by bringing Debbie Wasserman Schultz onto her staff, that she's really just thumbing her nose at those of us who are trying to be invested in a political process, that we want to see change, because truly we're disenfranchised. It's a rigged system. I'm just curious what your guests think about that.
Ken, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Matt Dickinson, pick it up.
Well, the caller is tapping into something here. There, and again, I allude to Trump's reference to the forgotten man. There's a segment of the electorate out there that feels like neither party represents them very well. And both Sanders and Trump have been trying to target that particular voting block. Now, the key, I think, that the caller alludes to is how do you institutionalize the Sanders movement when, as Jeff suggests, Sanders himself will no longer be as relevant once he's not a presidential candidate? And you do that through several ways. One, you spread seed money to focus building the party apparatus so that it's controlled not by Harry Reid but by people more sympathetic to you. We're seeing some of that transition now. Second, you run candidates who share your progressive values, and they begin to win, not just at the national level, but you have to start, like Newt Gingrich recognized, at the state and local level and create feeder for candidates as they move up, because effective candidates are candidates who have won previous elections. And three, we shouldn't underestimate the importance of the down-ticket ballot in November. Democrats have to regain the House. They have to regain the Senate. If they do, then they're in a position to push some of those issues that Sanders has gotten the Democratic Committee to at least aspirationally speak about on the Democratic platform.
And Matt Dickinson, do you see Bernie Sanders playing a role in all of that, or sort of ceding that to the people who are passionate about what he's been putting forth but not really being the one who's out there doing that?
Well, I don't think he or Elizabeth Warren are going to be the centerpiece of this movement, but they're certainly going to contribute to it. Sanders, of course, has a pot of money that he can distribute in certain ways under regulation. But it's really key to, again, to win back the majority in Congress. And then that gives Sanders chairmanships of key committees, and he can begin to start influencing these other factors, Democratic Party establishment and so on, that then set the rules for elections coming down the road. So you have to make a revolution, to sustain it, you have to work inside the party as well.
Jeff Charlotte, what do you think about looking ahead, looking past November?
I think Matt's right about the way forward if you want to institutionalize it, and I think that will happen. But I also think that what we've seen in Sanders and Black Lives Matter and environmental activism and Occupy Wall Street is that the future, the moment of the left in America right now, is very anti-institutional. It's the moment on the right too. We are in an anti-institutional age. And I think looking ahead, a lot of that energy, the real energy, is going to be coming from outside those channels. If those channels align, the inside the party left and the outside further left, it's sort of growing up. It's hard to say whether we might be in a moment of real change.
All right. Well, we'll see you guys both back here in a year or two or 10. Jeff Charlotte is an author and a journalist who focuses some of his writings on threats to American democracy. He's a professor at Dartmouth College. Matt Dickinson is a political science professor at Middlebury College. Thank you so much to both of you. Appreciate your insights today.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jane.
By the way, we do have coverage of the Democratic National Convention all this week from NPR and from the VPR team now in Philly to cover the convention. So stay with us for news, analysis, and speeches. Now, a year ago in August, Vermonters were horrified at the public murder of a social worker, Lara Sobel, in downtown Barrie. Among the witnesses who intervened that day was Scott Williams, the Washington County State's attorney. He knew both Sobel and the woman accused in her murder. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, Williams joins us to reflect on what unfolded that day, the impact it has had on him personally, and the reverberations of Sobel's murder on the community. Stay tuned, listen to Vermont Edition for that discussion tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.